Hey there, folks. We're kicking off today's episode with a cup of tea from the Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world directly from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. You can join us for a cup of tea and be part of the global impact they're creating by visiting nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com. Yikes, my cup of tea is already getting cold. So, why don't you join me and hop into today's episode?
Is it possible to do well while doing good in Africa? This week in the boardroom, we spoke to Ebenezer Asante, the Senior Vice President for Markets at MTN Group, whose leadership and business philosophy left us speechless. Hailing from Ghana and with a footprint of impact and success across the continent, Ebenezer firmly believes that it is possible to prioritize ethics and integrity while delivering stellar profits and business growth simultaneously. In this episode, we unpack the stories, strategies, and ideas that have shaped Ebenezer into a global executive whose track record is as clean as it is impressive. As we dig into the psychology of the African consumer, we also explore the tactics and mindset needed in order to build products and businesses that will stand the test of time. Join us for yet another fascinating conversation with a doer and thinker like no other.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whoever you are, wherever you are. Welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. You're joining myself, Sean Karanja, your host today, alongside Boniface Omina, aka the local noisemaker, aka the go-to guy for anything creative, anything events, anything entrepreneurship, you name it. My good friend Boniface is here with me today. It's always a pleasure to, you know, have us both in the boardroom. Today is Tuesday, so that means that it is a guest episode. And guys, we have an ongoing thing where we say no one can ever guess who we'd have next on the podcast. And today's no exception. This is an individual who we are thoroughly inspired by, who we consider as a pioneer in not just the world of business, but also from a leadership standpoint. And we are super excited as individuals who identify as young leaders to sit down with him and just pick apart some of the key elements of what his career has been like, some of the things he's been learning. But before we dig too deep into that, Boniface, how are you doing? You know, I've said that I'm here with my co-host. People might be wondering, is he there? Boniface, how's everything going?
Everything is going great, Sean. Usually putting out my accolades out there and being very humble about your own. But for our lovely listeners, if you're looking for anything venture capital, anyone to break down the different industry models on the continent and beyond, Sean is definitely your guy. And we're here to listen to another industry expert, a captain of his own industry. And yeah, this is a conversation that we've been looking forward to, more so because we've had a number of people within his network come on here and speak to us about different topics. And it's always lovely to hear from people with so much depth of wisdom and knowledge. And so that said, Sean, let us know who we have here today.
So today in the boardroom, we have none other than Mr. Ebenezer Chuom Asante, who is MTN's Group Vice President for West and Central Africa. Ebenezer, welcome to the boardroom. It's an honor to have you here, and we hope that you're doing well.
No, I'm doing well. And let me start by just letting you know that my designation has changed. Now I am the Senior Vice President for Markets. So I'm responsible for all the MTN markets apart from South Africa and Nigeria. And earlier on also, you described me as an industry expert. Humbly, I am only an industry server. I am serving in the industry, and I'm constantly learning myself. Because in technology, the moment you feel you have mastered it is the very moment you become a dinosaur. And I don't want to be a dinosaur. So I call myself an industry server, constantly learning. And giving this opportunity also learning from young people like you. Because the market that we serve, majority of them are within your age profile.
Definitely. Thank you for the clarification. And I can see that first thing that has jumped out is that you have a servant leadership attitude, because even in your introduction, you said, you know, you're a server. I'm curious to know, Ebenezer, who is Ebenezer? So if, you know, today one of our listeners is trying to figure out, you know, who is this gentleman? We know maybe he's Ghanaian. We know he's senior vice president of markets at MTN. But beyond the professional realm, give us a look into who you are, what makes you tick, what excites you from a day-to-day. And maybe you can give us a bit of overview, just high-level overview on some of what your career has looked like over the past couple of years.
So to describe what I do to a 10-year-old, I would say my job is a very simple one, to get smartphones into the hands of many Africans and those in the Middle East. And once they also get a smartphone, work with them to use it more often for their communication, and also to power their lives, whether they are transacting with their banks, whether they are buying insurance or paying for goods and services. I want to work with them to be able to make use of technology to do it more efficiently, more conveniently, and in a more cost-effective manner. So that is the way I would describe my role. Myself as a person, born and bred in Ghana, and in the past, I used to work for Unilever as an FMCG person myself for 13, 14 years. And I was privileged to have had that experience as management trainee, getting exposed to different aspects of the business within the first 2 years, from supply chain to commercial to finance to production. I had the opportunity to do some night shifts, but it was for a brief moment, but I really enjoyed it. And I have also, for the past close to 15 years, have been with MTN in the technology space. What make me tick is passion. What make me tick is purpose. What make me tick is the opportunity, the sheer opportunity in our continent. And even what many will see as problems and challenges in the continent, I only look at it as a stage of the continental development, and for which reason, irrespective of where we find ourselves, whether in corporate, in the private sector, civil society, public service, we need to play a role. So I try to play my role in solving part of the continent's problem, but doing it from the private sector.
That's beautiful, Ebenezer, and that's a wonderful way to kick us off. Speaking of 10 years old, I want us to take a trip down memory lane to when you were 10 years old, Ebenezer. And the reason for this is because one thing that we've grown to appreciate you on the podcast with the different guests that we have is taking a deeper look at their childhood experiences and childhood environments that really contributed to the people that they are today and the work that they do. So to give you an example, we had two separate conversations with Yao Nsako and Akosua Abame, and we learned that they were childhood friends, you know, friends since childhood, and have grown up together building their relationship and the impact of such relationships can have on not just who we are, but the work that we do. I'd love for us to take a few minutes to just speak to you about that, Ebenezer. For us to understand who you are today and the work that you do, what do we need to know about your childhood experiences and childhood environments growing up?
10-year-old Ebenezer was a primary school boy. I attended a mission school, which was a public school at the same time owned by the government, but run at the time by the Presbyterian Church. And that's where I had my primary. I used to walk to school even as a 10-year-old, carrying my slate, carrying my books, moving in throng with my friends and closing with them and playing with them. And I think I had every opportunity that a 10-year-old could have as far as playing was concerned. And also as far as playing pranks from time to time was also concerned. So I didn't miss any part of my you know, youthful days. And I really enjoyed it. And today, you won't believe it, sometimes I recount my experience to my children, how we enjoyed. Life has changed. We didn't have the benefit of computers. We didn't have the benefit of digitalization, but we had the benefit of improvisation. And that has lived with me, that when you grow up in an environment where even in the midst of nothing, you are not down often, but you still want to make the best out of that environment. The first thing that you learn in that environment is improvisation. The second thing that you learn in that environment is to work with everybody, because you don't have an option. Because if you don't learn to connect and relate, then you'll be one of the miserable people on earth. So at that stage, I learned a great deal of lessons from relationships, from improvisation, and also dealing with people from where they come from. Diversity was the order of the day. And that has helped me a great deal up to this stage.
That's fantastic. I can only imagine that, you know, 10-year-old you sitting down with you of today, the difference is probably so huge on a surface level. But what we tend to find is that we are just older versions of our younger selves in many different ways. And Ebenezer, I hope that 10-year-old you would be proud of you today. I'm very curious now about your 20s, right? So early, you know, university days, early professional life, because that's where Boniface, Yuri, and myself, we find ourselves there right now, where we're pursuing our degrees, gotten a bunch of, you know, certifications, you know, done our internships here and there, working, trying to build things, big dreams, big ambitions, lots of fears, lots of joys. I'm curious what 20-year-old Ebenezer in his early to mid-20s, around there, what was happening in your life and what was happening in the world around you as well, from a cultural standpoint, social standpoint? What were the trends going on that influenced some of the decisions you were making at that time?
So post forward my 10 years into the teens, the bulk of my teens, I also grew up during the former president, the late Jerry John Rawlings' regime. I'm sure you may have heard or read about his revolution. First as the leader in charge of the AFRC, and then later on the PNDC. So he is one man who stayed here several multiple coups. And I don't know of anyone who has been more successful as far as coup plotting is concerned than him. So I grew up knowing only him as the leader, okay? So even in my 20s, he was the only person that in my conscious life I knew as a leader. In my late teens, a lot of agitation, a lot of civil society push to return the country back to civilian rule. So that also, I saw a bit of it. So if you also look at my teens into my early 20s, Ebenezer grew up in an environment where he was quite conscious of the drive to get a country out of military dictatorship into civilian rule. The drive to, you know, get the country into democracy. I saw the transition, how it all happened, the attack that even on campus as undergrads we suffered in the hands of the police, the military. So there were times that we were on the street supporting the revolution, but there were also times when we grew, we were also on the street opposing the revolution. So I've seen both sides of the aisle, you know, supporting and opposing. So from that point of view, I believe I am wiser now. I understand the full import of what it took to get this country to a democracy. And so far, we now are talking about 30 years of Ghana in democracy. The verdict is out there. And I'm sure you've heard Yao's opinion on that. He continued to talk about it. Many others are also expressing their opinion. And we can only thank God for how far we have come. So in my 20s, apart from the political upheavals, apart from the agitations, apart from the push towards transitioning the country into democracy, we also did our national service. I don't know if you know about the national service in Ghana. It's a compulsory time that every young person will have to spend 1 year after sixth form in our time, and then another year after university. So after sixth form, I spent time teaching mathematics in the classroom. And then after university also, I spent that 1 year again teaching and researching, this time at the University of Ghana. And it was at that stage that I really knew my calling and felt that if there is any job at all that really respond to my own mission in life, it should be one of teaching. So even in corporate life, I never miss the opportunity to teach. And I know that one day when I'm done and hang my gloves, as far as corporate is concerned, I definitely will revisit the classroom. And all came during my 20s.
That's so beautiful, Ebenezer. And I think first question that comes to mind right now, as I hear you speak, I'm thinking about me in my 20s and some of the things that are happening in my environment. And you pointed to the fact that there was what was going on in the political landscape really affected sort of some of how you were approaching your decisions. And I'd be very curious to know, Ebenezer, what were some of the questions that you had about the next season of your life that you're making decisions for? What were there some fears that you're having at the time? And how did sort of this, the emotional aspect of what you were going through, how did that affect your decision-making during this season? Because it's something that's just very present in our lives. And we hear a lot of young people, some of whom are in our audience, speak about these things and feeling like they don't necessarily have a sounding board for some of these questions or people to speak to some of their fears about. How was this like for you when you were navigating this at our age?
Perhaps one of the things that the youth of today could be different from ours is the subject of fear. Throughout my 20s and my teenage, the circles that I moved within, the subject of fear was not there. And I don't know whether it's also because we didn't have much to lose, okay? Sometimes when you don't have much to lose, you have nothing to fear, as they say.
That's very true. You
now need fear no foe. So
yeah,
that could also be the issue. But today, with the benefit of my industry, everything is at your beck and call. you become even more conscious of how other youth within the country and beyond are living their life. And in the midst of all that, I think a lot of things get thrown in the air. And sometimes we are not able to pick the illusions from reality. We are not able to pick the hype from substance. And perhaps in dealing with the issue around fear, we also need to also try and unpack what is real, what is elusive, what is hype, and what is substance. And if we can then build ourselves around some core foundation and pillars, and that becomes the basis, the navigating force around which, as and when the forces in the air keep pushing us, we would always go back, then to a large extent, it can deal with the issue of fear. So it is very easy to sit here and tell you, don't fear anything. But I think before you can replace fear with something, it should be something more substantive. And build yourself in any way that gives you the confidence. Is it something philosophical based on your principles, something around your convictions, something about your belief system? They are all very, very important. But you must build yourself around something so that even when the difficulties and the challenges and the push, the hype and the illusion of life is thrown at you, you'd always have that core and to hold you to. And then it holds you first and foremost to the truth. We often talk about speaking truth to power, but you must speak truth to yourself. You should be able to see yourself in the mirror and see where you need to be different. And fear is there. You must find ways to deal with it. But to me, I believe if we can replace the niceties of hype and the blips in the air with something more substantive, to a large extent, it can deal with our fears.
Wow. I'm just sitting down right now. I mean, you know, you were very correct when you said that teaching is a core part of who you are, because you've literally just given us a very solid framework for how to replace fear with something a bit more pragmatic, which is a value system that's based on, you know, things that are important to us, be that, you know, a certain mantra you live by, your faith, your values. And I take it, and down in the later in the conversation, we'll dig into that when we speak about leadership. But let's quickly talk business, right? We've spoken about fear right now, and a fear that a lot of people have is doing business in Africa, and that, you know, I'm going to start my startup, or I'm going to try and push a product across different geographies or even just locally, but it won't go anywhere. Consumers are complex, you know, it's a big, scary continent, lots of different cultures, fragmented supply chains. I mean, you name it, there's always someone somewhere who's written an article about why not to do business in Africa. But I'd really love to hear your perspective on it, because you've been able to sit at the forefront of unloading one of, you know, the world's most transformative technologies, which is, you know, mobile technology across the continent. And we've seen just the huge impact that that has had. And by virtue of that, you've gotten an understanding of what the business and consumer landscape looks like in Africa. So give us a quick crash course on that. What do we need to know about Africa's business and consumer landscape as aspiring or current entrepreneurs?
First, you can look at all the chaos, all the fragmentation, all the informal structures, all the characterization that can define Africa. But I keep telling people, Africa is not for the light-hearted. And why is Africa not for the light-hearted? Look at our history. Our history has never been for the light-hearted to live in this continent. A history of colonialism and slavery, 400 years. And you and I are even part of the newborn continent in terms of when we took up the mantle for self-rule and independence. We have lived shorter in our own democracy and self-rule than others have led us and misled us and misruled us and mismanaged us and suppressed our confidence, suppressed our emotions, suppressed our psyche. It is part of who Africa has become. But I don't hold an excuse for us. It only means that we need to find a way to run twice, three times faster than the rest of the world. Because when you are coming from way behind, your history is important. You can't ignore it. But that history should also inspire you to rather, you know, run twice as fast. And I think that is where Africa is lagging. We talk about the history. We do all the rhetorics. But when the rubber hits the road, then we also let the past allow us to accommodate too much substandard mediocrity and, you know, tolerance for stuff that we should not be entertaining in the 21st century. So I can give you several examples of the challenges in Africa that others have run away from, but it took people with great insight to separate the real substance from the noise. Go to Nigeria. With the onset of telecommunication, a lot of business cases were written. A lot of business plans were written. Majority of them were rejected. In fact, I know of a major global telecom player today. After they have assessed that market in the 80s and 90s, they came to the conclusion that any telecom operator will be lucky to have 50,000 subscribers in a year in Nigeria. Because they pointed to all the issues. No electricity. Where would they be charging the phones? People would rather invest money to buy power than to buy phones. People would rather be looking for genset than to buy phones. Okay? They look at the chaos and they came to the conclusion that it was not possible. In my own country, in the 90s, I have seen a business plan for a mobile telecom operator in this market that was just around securing 1,000 subscribers and going to get them to pay so much for the service and ignoring and writing off all the regions of this country to say, if there is any place that has any semblance of hope to be successful with mobile telephony, it's Accra. And even for Accra, maximum 5,000 people. And for the 5,000 people, it will take about 5 years to reach them. And that is one of the propositions around which the market entrance was pitched. Today, see where we are. And even when you go back in history, the so-called 1,000 was realized in less than a month. It tells you that when I talk about Africa not being for the light-hearted, it is for business people and entrepreneurs and investors who want to understand business from the African perspective, the African consumer perspective, know the real difference between opportunity and the challenges to anchor those opportunities. And when you are able to have that humility to understand the society and its fabric, to understand the so-called informal sector, and I keep telling people that the informal sector is a sector in charge of the continent. So even when we talk about inflation and manipulating the monetary aggregates, we talk about inflation targeting, and we are looking at, you know, all the other things that we learned in Keynesian economics and macroeconomics at the university level. Sometimes I even feel that we miss the point. If you want to understand how money is moving in the economy, looking at the transaction flow of M-Pesa, for instance, it gives you an idea of what is happening, activity level. So if you really want to measure and gauge economic activity, you can look at it from that point of view. And it will surprise you that the level of economic activity at the so-called bottom of the pyramid is what is holding this continent. So for any business to come here without having deeper understanding around the informal sector and the power it wields, around the living conditions in the informal sector, whether you look at just people not wearing shoes and it's an opportunity for shoes, or you rather look at it as they being backward and they will never learn how to wear shoes. And unfortunately, for majority of the people seeking to do business in Africa, they come with that paradigm. When you go into the community and people don't have anything on, would you see it as an opportunity? Or you rather say, gosh, it will take these people more than 50 years to even learn how to put on the first clothing. So that humility to understand, that humility to uncover and unpeel the deeper insight around doing business in this continent, that humility to even know that in the midst of all the chaos and the complexity and the fragmentation and the informality may lie golden jewels that need to be minted, I think that should not be lost. Again, it does not give any African government the excuse not to try and formalize the informal sector, not to try and deal with the supply chain fragmentation, not to try and improve the doing business index in Africa. That is not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, even against the gradual progress that we are making, there is still a lot of opportunity in Africa. And for those multinationals who have been here for several years and may be exiting, they have just lost their pioneering spirit. The spirit that brought them business in Africa, they have just lost it. And the new cadres of leaders are looking at different prism of doing business. So when you shout the loudest about USG, and you shout the loudest about sustainability, and at the same time, you are exiting your business that you claim is responsible for vitality in Africa, then the hypocrisy and the double standards are seen.
Oh, wow, Benez, I think one of the call to actions that I'm getting from this conversation is, we just said, look at our history as Africa, not just the history of our countries, but also the history of our industries. And I think back to, I'm currently doing my final year dissertation on the Kenyan music industry, right? Looking at how music streaming platforms are contributing to their revenue generation. And what this really required me to do is go back to, is look at the industry from grassroots level. So a bottom-up sort of approach, and have conversations with different artists and different stakeholders. And one thing that really would come up over the course of our conversations, particularly with the artists, right? They'd be calling for a lot of accountability on the leadership side, right? The leaders of the industries, the people, the regulators, the platform owners. And this question of ethical leadership is one that's very interesting. And I'd love to get your two cents on it, Ebenezer, because it's the first line on your LinkedIn, right? The fact that you stand for purposeful and ethical leadership. In a lot of the work that we do in school, for example, right, it teaches us a lot about business and ethics. It teaches us how to critically analyze not just the economies of our countries, but the frameworks and systems that guide these economies, and more so the individual leaders in all these different spaces. And a lot of young people, as they look up to the leaders and see a lot of these problems that are going on, they feel discouraged to stick to their principles because most of them say that the system will eventually compromise us. I'd love you to speak to some of these people who made
very provocative subject you are raising, because if ever you feel discouraged to drop your principles, then you didn't have the principles in the first instance. I'm afraid I would be that blunt. Okay.
Yeah.
and the essence of ethics, as I say, first and foremost, your competence, your charisma, your abilities is what will open the door for you. Okay. And then once you enter, your relationship, your ways of work, your hard work is what will keep you in the room. But before everybody will leave that room and leave you in charge to run with everything there, they must trust you. They must find you dependable. Your word must carry some weight. Otherwise, they would always sleep with one eye open. And who would enjoy that kind of sleep? So it is your ethics. Your ethics. That is what defines and shapes you. And I have asked several leaders, so-called, that why do you want to be a leader? And I tell you, this simple question, I've not had many people answer it to my satisfaction. Why do you want to be a leader? And if your leadership is not anchored around some ethical human values, then I beg to differ. The fact that you are into something to impact life, that itself is ethical. The fact that you want your product to make a difference in the world, that itself is ethical. The fact that whatever you want to do, you want to make sure it does not impair life and the planet, that itself is ethical. So as far as I'm concerned, the foundation of everything is ethics. If you don't have it, you cannot begin to have principles. And link back to the point that I was making around fear. It's the same thing. When you build your ethics around some strong philosophy, some strong principles, some strong values, some strong belief system, it shapes and defines who you are. Okay? It shapes and defines who you are. And even when the environment is so tough and difficult and you have to stumble, when you stumble, you pick yourself up. And you don't blame the environment for stumbling. So that is where I belong. That yes, from time to time, we may all falter. From time to time, we may all stumble. From time to time, we may all even live below our own ethical expectations. But the truth lies in you seeing that, whew, this is not me. And quickly working your way back. But when you falter and don't even realize it, and you give the excuse that is a new norm, that is a new order, and I have to shape up in line with that norm and order, then I would say and argue that you didn't have the ethics in the first instance. So having ethics, ethical-driven leadership does not necessarily mean that you would always meet expectations, not at all. It does not necessarily mean that you would always, deliver in line with the standards that you hold yourself to. But at least it preserves you in terms of the anchor and the axis it gives you to measure your output. So I will not just measure my output in terms of the targets that I help MTN to achieve. If even that is the standard set for me, and thankfully, MTN set much higher standards, includes standards like net zero, includes standards like the quality of the delivery in terms of its impact on people, etc., etc. So at the end of the day, when it's all is said and done, yes, the numbers may be delivered, the targets may be made, but how they were delivered and met is also very important. Was I able to do it sustainably? Did I maintain relationship? Have I done it in a way to coach and guide others such that when I transition, there are others to take over from me? Or I was just selfishly doing it for my own self-praise and wealth? Okay? All those things goes and hones your ethical values. And at the end of the day, interacting and sitting with you, yes, I know that it has taken some time, but I was able to prioritize because it is also linked something about my ethics and what it means in terms of giving back to people like you. You know, so for me, look, maybe I may be a bit ideological about this subject, but if you don't have it and you can't nurture it, it is not something somebody can teach you in a classroom. And that is why, in spite of all the big corporate talk, we had a financial crisis. At the center of it, what was it? Ethics. Most of the financial crisis that we've had, at the center of it, ethics. Most of the things that brings big and mighty corporates on their knees, at the center of it, ethics. Great leaders in history, current, and in future, they will rise or fall at the center of it, ethics. So I cannot underestimate the value of ethics at all in leadership, in doing, in execution, in ways of life, and even in relationships.
Wow. What I'm hearing here is that it's not really what we do that's important. It's also how we get it done. A lot of us get obsessed with the metrics, the numbers, the optics of how things look to the external world, when in fact, how we do it probably is more make or break, not just to our character, but you know, to society at large. Because I had a conversation with a friend, and you know, it started off as a complaint about, oh, you know, our taxes are so high, but, you know, corruption is also, you know, on the rise. It was a very gloomy conversation. And at the center of it was just a realization that, yes, there's lots of good media about, you know, our nation that we love, Kenya. You know, there's great media out there. Oh, you know, Silicon Savannah, you know, startup capital of East Africa, etc. But you know, when you sit on the ground and you talk to the Uber driver, you talk to the lady at the shops, you talk to such and such person, they're not happy, and you know, they're calling on change to be made. They're calling on ethics to be prioritized once more. They're calling for accountability. So even if the metrics look good, the what looks good, you know, the how are we getting there, is something that I definitely hope a lot of our listeners and even us ourselves here in on this podcast take very seriously. So thank you for that call to action. And my next question to you is closer to, you know, what you had spoken about, how, you know, you're a teacher at heart, and I can tell that education is definitely a key priority for you and an area of interest and importance. And I just wanted us to quickly examine, you know, the transformative potential that education has, and fostering, you know, a knowledge-driven society, one that's focused on critical thinking, creativity, and innovation. How do you think those things now apply towards, you know, this dream we have for our continent, these personal dreams we also have? How does us investing in education and knowledge and all those things play into it? How have you seen that benefit?
Okay, so I look at education in two ways for the context of our discussion. Mm. One is education as a distributive force, what I call education as a leveler, which I was telling somebody, knowledge is knowledge. It does not know color, whether politics, it does not know status. It does not know your social background. Okay, once you emerge, you are able to use it to break the glass ceiling. So if there is any opportunity for us as Africans to really ensure equitable, you know, distribution of resources, I think a lot more must be invested in quality education. And in this day and age, when you talk about educating people, people are also quick to ask you, where will the jobs come from? Yes, let's solve the issue of jobs, but let's also not forget that if we provide the right quality education, that in itself can also solve the job challenge. So that puzzle can also be solved through providing good quality, curiosity-driven education. And if we even want to stretch further, everybody knows that in the next 30 to 50 years, the rest of the world will depend on Africa for their labor. And what kind of labor are we giving them? So we need to be ready for that, because the responsibility is going to befall us in the next 30 to 50 years. And African governments and African youth need to be ready for that in terms of the education that we provide. So I am a strong believer in the redistributive value of education. And then when it comes to the content, in terms of what kind of education is required, the debate has always been, should we not be training people on only the practical side of education? If everybody were to hold a business degree, then what happens to the other aspects of life? Your industry, music. Music itself formed a crucial part of the Renaissance, and it forms a great part of civilization, creative arts. So as far as I'm concerned, they are all equally important. And I tell you, even me, when I come to the moment of crucible and I have to make a very important and critical decision, I need some context. And sometimes my experience alone does not provide the context I need to make that decision. And I have to fall on history. So if I've not taken the time to train myself and understand about people, some historical figures in the past, what kind of history can I fall on to be able to make that important business decision? Somebody may do even archaeology at a university. And people will say, archaeology is only for excavation. Why do you need to learn prehistory and all that? But I say, the person who is digging to pick, you know, artifacts and put it all together, that person is able to connect the dot and understand the bigger picture. And when you put that person in business, if the person is a good archaeologist, the person can even become a better and a stronger leader, because he will be approaching business from very good, you know, anthropological basis, human understanding. And when it comes to decision making, they will be able to, you know, connect the dots to be able to think and create the needed foresight. And if you want to recruit the best of forensic experts, I think you should be looking to recruit them from archaeology schools. If you want to recruit the best of intelligence people, I think you should be recruiting them from archaeology school. So the graduate's ability to connect what they are studying and be curious about it and using it to solve real life problems, I think that is what most of the time is missing. And I think that is where the emphasis must be. And whatever you find yourself studying, if you are curious about it, you should be able to solve some real life problem. That is where I make a difference when it comes to even very early in my career, how I borrowed some concepts in economics and statistics. As a territory manager, I could link clearly resource optimization. That is what territory management is all about. I didn't learn sales at the university. But when it was exposed to me, I was able to connect it quickly. When I have to use statistical data to make analysis, I know that the trend is one thing, but the outlier can also, you know, teach you a lot. So I don't just follow the trend, but I will say, by the way, what is there in the outliers that I can learn from? Again, borrowing from theory and concepts and applying it in real life. And I think that curiosity around what we are learning and how we can apply it in real life, you don't need to be a sociologist to work for the UN as a sociologist. You can still use your sociology in the business world. You can use your history as a foundation to launch a great legal career. You can use your archaeology as a foundation to launch a great forensic career, et cetera, et cetera. That curiosity is what our education should be emphasizing.
Wow. Those are very powerful words.
I take it that you read a lot of... do you read a lot of autobiographies, perhaps?
I do.
You do?
I do.
That's interesting. Quick yeah. question. Who is your historical, I wouldn't say idol, maybe role model, someone who in the past has embodied maybe some principles that you hold dear today?
Look, I have not seen it one person because, look, we are all fallible.
Yes.
So the approach that I adopt is, I take great leaders in the past and I try to understand them. Sometimes I look at their conquest and ask how were they able to do it. And then I also look at, you know, how did they over time pain into irrelevance. People like, you know, Alexander the Great will come to mind, okay? And then when you go into my own faith as a Christian, the leader of all times is Jesus Christ. So sometimes I ask myself, if Jesus were here and watching me, how would he expect that I solve this problem? How would he expect that I relate with this person? How would he expect that I approach this matter? Because almost every single challenge that we are facing today has been faced in the past, but differently. The only difference is maybe in the past, they didn't have the sophistication of technology that we have today. But even when you go back 1,000 years, they believed they were more sophisticated than the people in the past. Same with the people 1,000 years away, we'll look at all the things that we are doing today and say, how primitive they were, you see. So when you look at history from that perspective, you learn a lot. You will not get everything you want to see in one person, but you see a lot and you also learn from their feelings.
That's a very important point right there. Ebenezer, learning from the mistakes of the past and just doing better. As we come to the end of this conversation, Ebenezer, this has been a fantastic time here in the boardroom. And just a parting short question to give the listeners a bit of a trailer into what to expect next from you. What does the present stage of your life hold for you, Ebenezer? What is exciting you right now and what are you excited about your future specifically?
In this continent, we still have about 350 million people who are not connected to the digital age. They don't even have the first means to do that, a smartphone. And that is a great passion of mine. And every day, when we look at the numbers, I am looking at how many people have been connected. And once they are connected, how do we ensure that we work with them through education to use it so they can get better value out of the smartphone beyond just communication and entertainment? How do we get them to use it to enhance their economic inclusion? How do we get them to use it to even ensure their farms? How do we get them to use it to improve their lifestyle, their health, et cetera, et cetera? That is my passion. And that passion is linked to my purpose. And that purpose is linked to my ethics. And it's the ethics and the purpose that says, everything I stand for, I should do so for the benefit of society. Yes, I get paid as a corporate leader, but I would be very vain if that is the main reason why I still remain at post. I visit a lot of markets, including some of the markets that many leaders will not want to go. But what is the passion point? Because when I go, I can see the difference between my last visit and today. And when I'm able to say that compared to the last time, I can see a lot more optimism on the faces of people on the street, and people seem to be going about their daily rounds with some purpose and hope, then I know that I'm also contributing my part. So if everything fails at all, service should not fail. Thank you.
Wow. That is so inspiring. And hopefully sometime soon we'll be able to come and accompany you in one of your ground on the ground visits. You do sound like a leader who is not just passionate about his cause, but passionate about other people's causes and how to enable that. And we really want to commend you for that, because it's not only inspiring, but that's the template that we should be taking forward into whatever field we're getting into. So to all our listeners who are listening today, thank you so much for joining us in this conversation with Mr. Ebenezer Chom Asante, the Senior Vice President of Markets at MTN Group. He's not only a corporate executive, but someone who is passionate about the nuts and bolts that go into building Africa. We are excited to share this episode with all our listeners. And to our listeners, we appreciate you so much for taking your time to listen to us today. We thank you so much. And a big thank you to Mr. Asante for joining us today. Listeners, have yourselves a fantastic week. From all of us in the boardroom, we wish you success in all your endeavors. Go out, be ambitious, be ethical, and don't forget to dream big. Thank you for tuning into today's episode. We shall see you on the next one.
Asante sana.